Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Professor Robert Alter, author of The Hebrew Bible, Translation with Commentary. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shinshiniot Young Representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benicot. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This past week gave us a view of Jews ascending to great heights and mired at the lowest swamps. And it's worth beginning our show today with a brief discussion of an important Jewish concept. Kol Yisrael arevim ze bazeh. Every Jew is responsible for every other Jew. That phrase is used throughout the Talmud and frequently in other classic Jewish texts, and it essentially means that even if we have never met them, even if we have no obvious connection to the triumphs and tragedies of Jews anywhere in the world, we feel pride in their accomplishments and are troubled by, even shamed by, their failures. Last week, the new Israeli project Bereishit, the Space IL lunar program, went up into outer space, launched on a SpaceX rocket. It marked the very first Israeli-designed and built craft to go so high and so far and linked tiny Israel with such space giants as America and Russia in its ability to soar beyond the stratosphere. And I suspect Jews all over the world felt a tinge of pride at that extraordinary accomplishment. Quite literally, Israel has never before soared so high. But last week also saw Michael Cohen, former personal lawyer for Donald Trump, both long before he was elected and during the first years of his presidency. Michael Cohen testified before Congress to both Mr. Trump's many failings and misdeeds and his own complicity in them. Last week also saw Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu indicted for corruption. Cohen spoke about his Holocaust survivor grandfather, his wife's Jewish refugee father, his own Jewish identity. Well, it was no secret before the hearing, nor before his own convictions for perjury and other crimes. And no matter where you sit on the political fence, there was nothing edifying in hearing about the level of corruption, intimidation, lying, conniving, and conning that routinely went on in the White House, and prior to that, in the president's business empire. And there's definitely no pride in knowing that a Jewish lawyer did so much of that dirty work for Mr. Trump. As Cohen said, he should have stopped being a blind follower much earlier. Easy to say now. Similarly, no matter whether you are a supporter or detractor of Prime Minister Netanyahu, you cannot feel good about the many violations of conflict of interest rules that Netanyahu and his wife appear to have broken, or enjoyed the many reports of slippery and illegal behavior. You know, there's something almost mystical about the sense we Jews have of responsibility for the acts of other Jews, acts which we neither had a hand in nor benefited from directly at all. But this last week was a reminder that we represent Am Yisrael, the people of Israel, in how we act and in what we accomplish. It is a great charge and should be both a point of pride and a signal element influencing our own behavior. We hope and pray that our own lives give pride to the people of Israel, the Jewish people. And we hope and pray that those Jews who fail will recover their sense of direction and ethics, and again make us proud of them and of being Jews. Kol Yisrael arevim ze bazeh. Each Jew is responsible for every other Jew. On a lighter note, we had a wild week of weather the week before last here in southern Arizona where I live, including a day of actual regular snow, on and off all day. For those of you listeners who live back east or in other real winter climates, this would have been no great treat. But since we only get snow about once every 5 or perhaps even 10 years in Tucson, for us it was a delightful novelty. Snow falling on palm trees and saguaro cacti, and the many surrounding mountains getting enough snow accumulation to make Tucson briefly look like Montana. But now Arizona's returned to the sun-drenched spring paradise it's supposed to be this time of year, which is appropriate, since this week we begin the month of Adar Sheni, second Adar, the month in which we celebrate the early spring festival of Purim. And so to play us in this morning as part of our pre-Purim musical preview, here's Al HaNisim from Yizhar Cohen, the prayer thanking God for the miracles done for our ancestors at this time of year in those days long ago.
Al HaNisim ve'al ha'purkan ve'al ha'gvurot ve'al ha'chuot ve'al ha'michamot she'asit ha'raboteinu ba'yamim ha'em bazman hazeh. Al hanisim ve'al hapurkan ve'al hagurot ve'al hachuot ve'al hamilchamot she'asit rabotenu bayamim ahem bazman hazeh. Al hanisim ve'al hapurkan ve'al hagurot ve'al hachuot ve'al hamilchamot she'asit rabotenu bayamim ahem bazman hazeh. Al hanisim ve'al hapurkan ועל הגבורות ועל הצ'ועות ועל המלחמות שעשית לבתינו בימים בהם בזמן הזה. על הניסים ועל הפורקן ועל הגבורות ועל הצ'ועות ועל המלחמות שעשית לבתינו בימים בהם בזמן הזה. Al hanisim ve'al hapurkan ve'al hagvurot ve'al hachuot ve'al hamilchamot she'asit rabotenu bayamim ahem bazman hazeh. Al hanisim ve'al hapurkan ve'al hagvurot ve'al hachuot ve'al hamilchamot she'asit rabotenu bayamim ahem bazman hazeh.
That was Al Hanisim for the Festival of Purim coming up March 20th and 21st. Our guest this morning is perhaps the greatest scholar of the Hebrew Bible working today. Professor Robert Alter's theories on the construction of the primary text of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and really all Western civilization, changed the way we understand and read the Bible. Robert Alter has just published his complete translation of and commentary on the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, and we'll meet him and find out how this extraordinary accomplishment ended up occurring. It's a surprising and entertaining tale indeed. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Cohen Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Cohen and Irma Cohen, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Cohen Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Cohen Foundation Award, please go to CohenAward.com, CohenAward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is CohenAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Professor Robert Alter might be the greatest scholar of the Hebrew Bible writing today. His new translation of the entirety of the Tanakh has been published recently. He's an American professor of Hebrew and comparative literature at the University of California, Berkeley. He has been there since 1967. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning.
So you started, I think, with Genesis, and you worked your way through Divrei Hayamim, the Chronicles. Tell us a little bit about that journey of translation and interpretation.
Well, it was an unintended journey. That is, for various reasons, I ended up tackling Genesis with no idea of going beyond Genesis. And I launched that translation with considerable skepticism about what I was doing, because I wanted to convey in English much more of the literary subtlety and power of the Hebrew style. And I was quite aware that the structure of the two languages is very different, and the semantic range of many of the key terms is very different. So I figured this really isn't going to work. It's a quixotic idea. It worked better than I thought, and then the Genesis was very well received, so I said, okay, I'll do just one more book of the Bible. I'll do Samuel together with the first two chapters of 1 Kings, because that's my other very favorite stretch of narrative in the Bible.
The whole David narrative.
Yeah, right. And then my editor came out to see me in San Francisco, and he suggested, well, why don't you do the whole Hebrew Bible? That's what we'd love you to do. And I said, oh, please, give me a break. So we spoke for a while and agreed on my doing the Torah, the five books of Moses, and I did that, and that got a very wide and mostly very enthusiastic reception. So I was encouraged, and it even sold well.
It's a beautiful volume, by the way, for those who don't have it. It's great.
So I was encouraged to do something more, and I did Psalms, which also was very widespread. People seemed to like it a lot. So I thought I'll go on and do a few more books, and then I did the Wisdom books, which, of course, is not a unit in the Jewish canon, but it's something scholars agree on. That is Proverbs, Kohelet, and Job. Well, I did one thing and another, it's a little bit like what Aaron says when he explains to
Moses about the golden calf, right?
You know, I threw in these golden jewelry, and out came this calf. So actually what happened, to make a long story short, is that about 4 years ago, like, I looked over my shoulder and said, hey, I've done almost two-thirds. If I can get through the prophets, I can do the whole thing. And that's how I ended up where I did.
It's a great story. It almost sounds a little bit like the whole way the Tanakh happened, but we can talk about that more when we return in a moment with our guest, Professor Robert Alter, here on Two Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a vibrant new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates its first services, classes, and events this winter and spring. Established by a group of passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Congregation Beit Simcha is dedicated to creating a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in the foothills in northwest Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan Tucson area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Our magnificent new Beit Simcha home at 3001 East Skyline Boulevard on the northeast corner of Skyline and Campbell across from La Encantada has services, classes, and events that are open to all. Join us Friday night at Skyline and Campbell. Shabbat services are at 6:30 p.m. Normally Saturday morning Torah study at 9 a.m. and services at 10, and this week a very special Shabbat morning hike and Torah service at the gorgeous Seven Falls in Bear Canyon with me. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, our rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, go to www.BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A Tucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona at its exciting beginning. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, toojewishradio.com, streaming us from there, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden. Amir, one of the things we haven't spoken about over the many times we've spoken is your own Israeli story and your dad's Israeli story.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Good to be here. Welcome.
So I'm a fifth generation in Israel, and my ancestors actually lived in Jerusalem. So we say my father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, my great-great-grandfather.
All Yerushalmim.
Yerushalmim, yeah. And the name was Tenenbaum before it became Eden, you know, after the establishment of the state. And then before that, Hungary and Russia. Those are the two places from my dad's side. And my grandmother came from Germany. So my dad was born in Tel Aviv, not Jerusalem, in Tel Aviv. He was born in Tel Aviv, and his parents were happily married for a very short time, and then after having him, they got divorced. My grandfather went to Paris. My grandmother went to New York, to Manhattan, and they left my dad in Israel with strangers who they said they'll send money to. And
oh my goodness!
So he was in Tel Aviv in with a family, Sarah and Mordechai, and then from there the family found out that he's there, and they sent him to England to boarding school. And when he was 13 years old, he wanted to go back to Israel, and he didn't have, you know, any family in England, and wanted to go back. So he just went on a boat.
At the age of 13
alone, without letting anyone know or buying a ticket. It was a cargo ship of Tzim, and went to Haifa.
He was a stowaway,
yes,
basically.
Yes, absolutely. Wow. And went to Haifa's port, back to Israel, and then from there to Tel Aviv, and then to a kibbutz. And so he had two families, one family in Tel Aviv, one family in a kibbutz. And after that, he found out that he has actually a mom in New York, and she flew him to New York, came to New York, but felt that Israel is his home and not the States, and went back to Israel. My grandmother remarried twice and had a son here, who's my uncle, who's a circuit judge now in Florida, you know, born and raised in the States. My dad was always in Israel, and I was born to a mom who came from Romania when she was 2 years old. And dad, as I just shared with our listeners.
Wow.
So, you know, having a dad that really didn't have a father as a role model was tough because there were many things that he just didn't know, you know, what the dad should do. So that's basically
wow,
the story.
Wow, it's an incredible story.
Yeah.
And so he was really, raised by the country of Israel, you could
correct.
Almost say.
Just, yeah, yeah.
Not by his parents.
Yeah.
It's an amazing story.
Yeah, and when he was 18 years old, he joined the Israeli army. He got a letter from his new stepfather from New York, who was a lawyer, who wrote to him, look, you can't do it to your mom, and you have to come to New York and not go to the army. And he wrote back and said, when I was... hungry or when I was sick, she wasn't here, and I have to protect my country, and he went to the army. And 25 years after, I did the same. I went to the army. She wrote me a letter, this time not my mom, but my grandmother in New York, saying, you know, you can't go to the army because I don't want to lose you like I almost lost your dad, and I want you to come to the States. And I wrote back and I said, look, I can't be the son of my father and not go to the army, which I did.
Incredible story. You know, countries are built out of such such complicated ways, but right. Israel especially so.
Yeah,
I agree. It's a great story. Thank you so much, Amir. We'll
talk
next
week.
You're
welcome. Bye.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about the issue of memory, particularly in Eastern Europe and remembering the Holocaust. You know, we Jews are the people of memory. So many commandments are Zachor et Yom HaShabbat, you know, remember the Sabbath day, or remember what Amalek did to you. You know, there's so much about memory. The Baal Shem Tov says memory leads to redemption, sometimes. The question that I have, and I think the issue that's so important now, is people seem to want to remember, for example, the period of the Shoah. Everybody in this country was an anti-Semite. Everybody collaborated. Or there were all these righteous Gentiles in this other country, and they saved Jews. It was never that simple. And it's not so simple in remembering it now.
Right. Nothing in history is ever totally black or totally white. And human nature is that we want white hats and black hats. We want who were the good guys, who were the bad guys.
Who's wearing the star and who's right. wearing the black hat.
I mean, we want to be able to say the Poles were worse than the Germans, or the Germans were worse than the, whatever. We want to kind of rank order, and we want to oversimplify. And in all of these countries, I mean, I remember the vice president of the Austrian parliament was a woman who was raised as a Jewish child in Vienna. Her parents sent her in 1938 to Berlin because they thought that in Berlin she would have the best chance of surviving the storm that was to come. Mm. Now, it turns out, historically, Berlin is a very tolerant place, and the only place in Germany where a synagogue actually survived was Berlin.
Since that was the center of the Nazi Reich, it's still stunning.
Right. And this woman not only survived, but thrived and became the vice president of the parliament and an active politician. And she would be the first person to say, not all Germans are the same. And I think we have to remember when you deal with, I mean, first of all, even one human being is so complicated and complex that he or she is not the same from one day to the next, from one moment to the next. We're all evolving constantly and changing. And how much the more so is this true for a whole nation or whole people? So, I mean, I was, as you know, within the past year in Lithuania with a group that was largely Jewish in its interests and its focus on history. And there were a few people with family roots in Lithuania. We had a tour guide who took us around the old ghetto in Vilna and a monument to the Vilna Gaon. And she knew a lot of Jewish history. And somebody said, why do you know so much about Jewish history? 9 members of her family were recognized by Yad Vashem as righteous among the Gentiles.
9
right.
righteous Gentiles in her own family.
Right. Maybe. So, you know, saying that all Lithuanians were vicious anti-Semites is clearly not true. But more to the point, Lithuania is going through this national soul-searching now because a lot of people that they were brought up to believe were heroes of the anti-Soviet resistance and or, depending on the period, heroes of the anti-Nazi resistance also turn out to have been vicious anti-Semites who organized and directed mass slaughters of Jews in various towns all over Lithuania. Hmm. So how do they reevaluate those people? Are they flawed heroes? Are they villains? I mean, they don't know what to do with this, really. And politically, it's very sensitive because it touches the core of Lithuanian national identity. I think it's safe to say that Jews are not the only people for whom memory is important. And I think it's safe to say we're not the only people for whom memory can sometimes be difficult.
And controversial. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Benny the matchmaker goes to see Abe, a confirmed bachelor. Abe, you mustn't wait too long. I have exactly the girl you need. You only have to say the word and you'll be married in no time, says Benny the matchmaker. Don't bother, says Abe. I have two sisters at home who look after all of my needs. Well, that's all well and good, says Benny, but all the sisters in the world cannot fill the role of a wife. I said two sisters, Abe answered. I didn't say they were mine. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our young Shinshiniyot on Israel, Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benakot. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
Well, Israel is headed to the moon. The Breshit Space IL project is off. What do young Israelis think about this?
So from my point of view, I do think it's really amazing. I think that getting to the moon and sending something to the moon as the fourth country that does it after three big nations, it's pretty impressive. I mean, like,
right there with like the U.S. and Russia, right?
Right.
Like, that's pretty amazing. I guess
China,
too.
I mean, are we
in
the same level? I don't know, but it's pretty cool. And I think the project itself and the fact that they did it kind of helps us be more proud and see that Israel is a really big, like, a science center, you know?
Right. And you're kind of a science person, right, Ron? I mean, this is like over home plate for you, which won't mean anything to you because it's a baseball analogy, but it fits into what you're most interested in, right?
Yeah, I do like all the things that has to do with science and math and all those kind of things. I think I'm really like a calculated person, you know? And
what do they say? Left brain, right brain? I always get confused which side. Anyway, you're the math science brain.
So it's pretty cool. I mean, I'm really amazed by that.
Have you been following all the details? Have you both been following what's going on?
So I think the Bereshit thing is really important to us as Shinshiniyot because it's also a really big subject to talk about with the people we work with the people we volunteer with. So I've been searching a lot in the internet. We've been searching on the internet about videos and about articles that can really relate to also young people, because one of the things that has to do with Bereshit is not only that we're a startup nation, we're sending a rocket trip to the moon, it's to inspire young people to follow their dreams and do what they believe in. And I think that's a really important message to bring also Israel, and also that message to the people we volunteer with. I think it's amazing. So I've been following, like, sort of, but I've been really looking into videos and articles.
It's inspiring. It's incredible to think that a nation that I think we were talking of beforehand, that there's Israel is 101st in the world in population, right? So, I mean, not really a large country in population, not a physically large country. It's probably the same size as Pima County, where we are now. A lot of people say it's the same size as New Jersey. I mean, you know, like, not a big place, really. And yet this is an incredible accomplishment. Do you think it'll inspire more Israelis to go into, as though they weren't all already inspired to go into high tech, but to go into science and real, you know, kind of hard sciences?
I think that yes, just because we can see that even though we're a small country, we can do really great things and big things and be heard by the world. Is that, can I say that?
Okay. By the whole world. Or people outside of the world if there are any out there. Thanks so much. We will talk next week.
Thank you.
Bye.
And now a word of Torah. This week we finish reading the book of Exodus with the portion of Pekudei, which completes the work and dedication of the tabernacle in the wilderness, first central place of worship for Jews. The purpose of this shrine is unclear initially. After all, if God exists beyond time and space, has no physical manifestation at all, that is, if the Jewish idea of God is correct, then why does God need any kind of fixed place of residence? Of course, the answer is that it isn't God who needs the tabernacle or the temple in Jerusalem or any sanctuary or chapel of any synagogue or temple anywhere in the world at any time in history. It's we who need it. You see, human beings can think abstractly and say that we don't need rituals or rites, that we are much too sophisticated to require places for prayer or even to need to pray at all. But when we are alone or in pain, when we are lost, when our minds aren't dulled by television or email, the internet or phones or other distractions, we find that we still have spiritual need. And that need is not abstract, but concrete. We need a place of solace and separation from the outside world, a location where we can seek God and our own best nature in serenity and peace. In short, we still need a temple, just as our ancestors did, for it is there that we find holiness in a world dedicated to the ordinary. Of course, you can pray anywhere, but having a place of beauty and specific sanctity, well, that can make all the difference. Poet Ruth Brin wrote, "Babel was built to defy deity, to declare the dominion of man. Bricks were passed from hand to hand for a whole year to reach the masons at work on the top of the tower. When a brick fell, they wept. But when a man toppled to his death, they turned their backs. The Tower of Babel was built to glorify man, but they achieved degradation and destruction. The sanctuary was built in obedience to God, in recognition of God's dominion. That tent proved to be far greater than the tower. Hangings of cloth outlasted brick and mortar. In the ark, built to the glory of God, we find our own essential glory, righteousness and holiness in imitation of God." When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Professor Robert Alter, who does all of his great translation and commentary work using yellow legal pads, will explain why the Bible somehow remains incredibly contemporary and what has challenged him in translating its entirety. Find out from this great scholar when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Chief Rabbi of Argentina was brutally assaulted by a gang that broke into his apartment last week. Rabbi Gabriel Davidovich was hospitalized with serious injuries, including 9 broken ribs. According to the Jewish political umbrella in Argentina, the president, Jorge Nablovitz, "We know that you are the Amia rabbi, the Jewish center rabbi," the assailants shouted before they beat Davidovich. His wife was home during the attack, which happened at 2 a.m. in the Jewish neighborhood of Once in the Argentine capital. The attackers restrained her and stole money and belongings. The attack was a brutal anti-Semitic aggression, the Argentine Jewish organization said in a statement signed by Nablovitz. It was framed on the anti-Semitic events taking place in different European countries which threaten coexistence and democratic values. A statement issued by AMIA, the Jewish center in Buenos Aires, condemned the attack. It did not specifically call it anti-Semitic, however. Davidovich has served as chief rabbi in Argentina since 2013. The office of the rabbinate is located in the AMIA building in Buenos Aires. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu sent wishes for a quick recovery to the rabbi and his wife. "We must not let anti-Semitism rear its head," Netanyahu said. "I strongly condemn the recent acts of anti-Semitism and call on the international community to take action against it." The World Jewish Congress said it was shocked and incensed by the brutal attack. It is not yet clear whether this was a targeted crime of hateful anti-Semitism or a barbaric criminal act, but we trust the authorities in Argentina will continue to do everything in their power to determine the motive and bring the perpetrators to justice, said Robert Singer, the CEO of the World Jewish Congress. In other news, in an ugly Israeli political deal, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu worked out an agreement with the Kahanist Jewish Power Party to run alongside his own Likud party in the April elections for the Israeli Knesset on his list. A huge controversy erupted over Bibi choosing to bring into his coalition the small, avowedly anti-Arab racist party that follows the outlawed teachings of the late Rabbi Meir Kahane and advocates expelling all Arabs from Israel. Netanyahu responded by claiming that the Israeli Labor Party partnered with anti-Zionist Arab parties to remain in power more than 20 years ago in the mid-1990s. However, a fact check shows that Arab parties were never part of any Labor government and never did align with the Labor Party in any official way, unlike this. The Jewish Power Party has come very close to advocating terrorism. It is certainly racist. Kahane himself, in his life, was jailed in Israel for advocating violence against Arabs, and his party, Kach, was outlawed for performing and inciting acts of Jewish terrorism. This latest version of the Kahanist vile and racist philosophy is not materially better, and Netanyahu's embrace of this splinter group, while certainly not reflective of Bibi's own beliefs, assuming he has beliefs, does him no credit. Netanyahu is trying to hold on to power. In that circumstance, politicians often get into bed with people who are far from savory, but the Kahanists have always been considered beyond the pale of Israeli politics and should have remained there.
Hooray for Hollywood, that's gooey ballyhooly Hollywood, where any office boy or young mechanic can be a panic with just a good-looking pan.
I know this may come as a shock, but there were many Jewish figures prominent in the 2019 Oscars ceremony last week. In particular, an Israeli director won the Best Live Action Short Oscar Award and cited the Holocaust in his acceptance speech. "I moved here 5 years ago from Israel. Laila Tov Yisrael," said Guy Nativ, accepting the award for his short Skin about former skinhead group member Byron Widener and his transformation. "My grandparents are Holocaust survivors. The bigotry they experienced in the Holocaust we see everywhere today, in America, in Europe. This film is about education, about teaching your kids a better way." Other Jewish nominees did not take home Oscars, including Rachel Weisz, up for supporting actress in The Favorite, and the Coen brothers, whose script for The Ballad of Buster Scruggs was up for Best Adapted Screenplay. The Coens, Joel and Ethan, previously won for No Country for Old Men, however. Black Klansman, co-written by Jewish writers Charlie Wachtel and David Rabinowitz, did win the Best Adapted Screenplay Award. Film centers on the first African-American cop in Colorado Springs police force who teams up with a Jewish detective to infiltrate the local Ku Klux Klan. Barbara Streisand gave a passionate introduction for the video summarizing Black Klansman and noted that after she first praised the film, she and Spike Lee, the filmmaker, had an easy conversation about it since they're both from Brooklyn.
In the shadow.
Shallow, the Lady Gaga-Bradley Cooper duet from Star is Born, won for Best Original Song for the writing and producing team that included a Jewish songwriter, producer, and DJ, Mark Ronson. The Oscars evening opened with a performance of We Will Rock You, We Are the Champions by members of Queen with Jewish singer Adam Lambert.
Singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy again.
Stanley Donen, the last surviving great director of the Golden Age of Hollywood, passed away last week. Donen was a Jewish kid from the unlikely location of Columbia, South Carolina, who started as a dancer in a Broadway chorus line, became friends with Gene Kelly and somewhat his choreographer, and grew into the director of such classic musicals as Singing in the Rain, On the Town, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, The Pajama Game, Damn Yankees, and many non-musicals, including the classics Indiscreet and Charade. Stanley Donen is largely credited with taking the movie musical and turning it into a comprehensive art form. A key ally of Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn said the British party is too apologetic over anti-Semitism. The remark by Member of Parliament Chris Williamson, the latest twist in a three-year saga over the proliferation of anti-Semitic hate speech in Labour, highlights claims the party's leadership is split on whether to even address the problem. "We have backed off too much. We have given too much ground. We have been too apologetic," Williamson said this month at a speech during a gathering of Corbyn's supporters. Four Labour lawmakers condemned Williamson's comment. Since his election in 2015 to head the Labour Party in Britain, Jeremy Corbyn has fought allegations his critical attitude towards Israel and alleged, well, definite tolerance of anti-Semitism have injected hatred of Jews into the heart of the party. In 2009, he called Hamas and Hezbollah his friends and said that Hamas is working to achieve peace and justice. In 2013, he defended an anti-Semitic mural. In 2014, he laid flowers on the graves of Palestinian terrorists who murdered Israeli athletes in Munich in 1972. In 2015, Corbyn said British Zionists don't understand British irony. Williamson this month booked a room in Parliament for a screening of a film by activist Jackie Walker titled Witch Hunt about her suspension from Labour over being an anti-Semite. Last week, nine lawmakers quit the Labour Party, criticizing the leadership's handling of anti-Semitism. One of them, Luciana Berger, last week tweeted in response to Williamson's words, "This is what I have left behind. It's toxic." And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Professor Robert Alter, one of the great biblical scholars in the world, has completed his full translation with some commentary of the Tanakh. It's a beautiful translation, published in 2018, not very long ago. He's also the author of the seminal book, The Art of Biblical Narrative, and many other books on the Bible. I want to ask a little bit about the Art of Biblical Narrative, in which you posit that prose was such a critical element in the composition of Torah, sort of the first great text written in prose. Tell us a little bit about how that idea evolved and how that became, I think, one of the most influential books of biblical scholarship in a very long time.
The point of departure for that perception is that most ancient narratives are written in poetry. On the Greek side, as far as I know, the first extended prose narrative is Herodotus.
Right, which
and,
is the...
And that's after the two Homeric epics.
Right, the Iliad and the Odyssey,
after
of course.
Hesiod and so forth.
Right.
There's a reason for that. Maybe the main reason is it seems to be the fact that most older writings are not writings. They're composed orally. It's what scholars call the oral formulaic method of composition, so that the Homeric bard would strum on some kind of stringed instrument, and he had this traditional story, and he had a set of formulas like rosy-fingered dawn and the wine dark sea, which you could plug in to get the right meter for each line. And he composed his poem that way. He composed some great poetry. But writing in ancient Israel and altogether in the ancient Near East is quite early. It goes back well before Homer. And there were these writers of extraordinary gifts who started composing narratives in, and I think poetry also, in prose. Now, when you sit down with pen and parchment and start writing, you're handling a much more flexible medium than the bard who is improvising orally. You know, you can shift things around, you can manipulate syntax, you can make very artful choices of particular words to highlight themes and so forth. And so it all came together, I think, in a narrative art that really is unsurpassed in the ancient world.
It's extraordinary. I've tended to think about it, even theologically. You know, poetry lends itself to multivalence, to all kinds of interpretations. Prose can, of course, do that too, but it's really easier to say one thing in prose and mean one thing. That was quite a revolutionary idea. I don't know of any other ancient texts of similar length or importance to the Torah that were written in prose.
I don't think so. As I said, not until you get to
Herodotus, yeah,
and that's just kind of
fourth century or something,
more or less historical,
right?
One of my favorite books you did with the illustrator R. Crumb. When you took your the book of Genesis, and it became fascinating graphic novel. What do you think looking back on that text today?
Well. It was a kind of fun production. I didn't work face-to-face with R. Crumb. He lives somewhere in the south of France, and he's a rather peculiar man. But he wrote me. He had undertaken, under contract, to do a graphic novel version of the Book of Genesis. And when I said a graphic novel version, not just some frames from time to time, but he illustrated everything, including the begats.
And, yes, he did, didn't he?
And he sent me the first 11 chapters, I think it was, of Genesis, and said, take a look at this. I'd like to use your translation, but I'd like to use it as the spirit dictates, interspersed with the King James Version. So I was very taken by his art, so I said, okay, let's do it. Now, the one thing I must say that I was not totally thrilled with is that when he used my translation, from time to time, he decided to change it. Here and modify it according to his taste, which are not my taste, but right. There it is.
In writing your translation of the Tanakh, what was the most difficult book for you to translate? What gave you the most trouble?
I think the most difficult, but in a way also the most satisfying, was the Book of Job, for two reasons. One, as you probably know, Job poses enormous textual difficulties. The text seems corrupted in certain places, maybe in a lot of places,
right.
And some passages seem to have been moved around into the wrong place. Teacher of mine, H.L. Ginsberg, I think once said that it's well known that in the book of Psalms.
Oh, in Psalms, yeah, sorry.
There's no connection between one chapter and the next. In the book of Proverbs, often no connection between one verse and the next. But in Job, there's often no connection between one word and the next. So that. And one which I couldn't totally overcome, because we really can't recover the original behind corrupted texts in most instances. But the other challenge, a satisfying one, which I don't claim to have overcome in every instance, was that this, where the text is not corrupted, this is astounding poetry. I think it's among the greatest poetry that's come out of the whole ancient world in any language. And I wanted to try to get something closer to the power of the Hebrew, to remain faithful to the Hebrew while giving my verse translation rhythmic integrity and giving it something of the powerful compactness of the Hebrew. So that was a challenge, but it was a fun challenge.
It has been said, I think accurately, that every translation is an interpretation.
Of course.
Do you have a particular perspective on, now having done so much and such important translation, do you think that there's some elements in your translations that come, I don't want to say biased, but have a particular perspective?
Well, sure. Let's see, one thing is concreteness. That is, over the centuries in many translations, beginning with the Septuagint and the Latin, the Vulgate, the Hebrew text has been pushed in the direction of abstraction. That is, biblical Hebrew is extremely concrete. It even uses, as in Kohelet and Ecclesiastes, it uses concrete metaphors where other kinds of philosophic texts would use abstractions. And it's also a language powerfully anchored in the body, in the human body. So I try to get this, I think, a good deal more than other modern translations have. I try to get this into the English.
So when you finish translating the entirety of the Tanakh, what do you do next? How do you follow that?
Well, I've actually done a very little book. It's a relief, no doubt, to readers as well, that it's a little book after this three-volume, more than 3,000-page production. And it's a book that it'll be out actually in about a month.
Great.
Princeton University Press is doing it. It's called The Art of Bible Translation. And it is a book about, how should I say, all the ways in which the modern translations by committee go gravely wrong, with a series of proposals of how you could do it better. And it ends up also being a kind of, I didn't intend this, but I saw they ended up doing it, a kind of introduction to the major features of Hebrew style in the Bible. That is, there's a chapter on word choice, a chapter on syntax, a chapter on rhythm, and so forth.
I want to thank Professor Robert Alter for a great visit here on Too Jewish. His translation of the Bible is, of course, available everywhere. Where can people go to find out more about you and about your work?
Well, I don't really have a website. I guess they could go to Wikipedia.
The universal source of all knowledge. Thank you so much. It was really a great pleasure and a privilege.
Well, it's a very nice talking with you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Professor Steve Zipperstein, National Jewish Book Award winner, author of Pogrom, Kishinev, and the Tilt of History. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from our pre-Purim musical preview. It's the Maccabees, semi-classic, semi-parody of singer Pink's Raise Your Glass. By the way, Pink, whose real name is Alicia Beth Moore, is Jewish, which is great, because she's also a terrific singer, songwriter, and performer. Anyway, the Maccabees didn't have to change the theme much on Raise Your Glass, celebrating the upcoming Festival of Purim coming March 20th and 21st. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Stand for a tale so grand. Shushan is the place where it all began, the hidden miracle. One man, second in command, slay all the Jews with his wicked plan, a scheme so miserable. He chose a day for the disaster.
didn't know a girl named Esther would turn it upside down. So raise your glass if you can see the hidden meaning, it's right in front of you. We will never be, never be anything but proud to tell the story, then I'll for who. Won't you come on and come on and raise your became the queen, cause God was pulling strings from behind the scenes. She wore the royal crown. 3 days the Jews just prayed.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.